Well, we're all too aware of those populists around the world. Jeremy Corbyn, Bernie Sanders on the left, to Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen on the right. Well, to what extent do they pose a threat to public policy and public discourse? And how should genuine liberals respond to the rage of the populists? Well, I recently attended the Mont Pelerin Society in Stockholm. That's a distinguished group of classical liberal thinkers who seek to reduce the size and the scope of governments around the world. And this year's conference theme, the populist threats to free societies and the reconstruction of the liberal project. Now, one of the speakers is my next guest. Karen Horn is a lecturer in the history of economic thought at Humboldt University in Berlin. She's also the editor and co-president of the Naus Network. Karen, welcome to Radio National.
Thank you.
How would you describe populism?
There are, of course, many definitions of populism. There is a classical use of it where people use it to describe opportunistic politicians simply who choose to put their mouth where the votes are. But that doesn't take us very far. That would mean that everybody is a populist who wants to get re-elected or elected in the first place. Others use the notion to describe modern extreme right ideologies only, but that doesn't help you either, because what do you do with someone like Hugo Chavez then, who certainly was an all right winger but very much a socialist? So I think it makes much more sense to adopt a historically and theoretically informed vantage point to describe populism. Populism saw the light in the end of the 19th century in the U.S., and from the beginning, its distinctive feature was the cult of the common man, where the common man was pitted against the elites. In those days, it was mostly money elites, political elites in particular, but also racial elites. And this attitude prepared the ground for the application of what I call, in more theoretical terms perhaps, the exclusionary logic. A populist is someone who feels entitled to define the people in the first place based on some notion of who that is, the common man, and coming up with a homogenous in-group. This in-group will then be pitted against all the others to whom you would deny legitimacy: non-natives, Jews, Muslims, blacks, gays, what have you. And this is really what stands at the heart of modern populism and what makes it distinct from other kinds of extremism.
That's right. So you say that this populism is a different brand of extremism. What do you think distinguishes, say, left-wing populism from, say, right-wing populism?
Okay, well, modern populists are very much capable of mixing the two. They sometimes mix left-wing and right-wing elements in their policy proposals. In the economic sphere, one would, of course, say that left-wing means more government intervention and less openness for the market. In the societal sphere, it is right-wing that means more government restrictions and less openness for spontaneous evolutionary coordination. Now, as I said, the trend seems to be that populists mix left-wing economic programs with right-wing societal politics. So we end up calling someone a right-wing populist when the elements of this program are mostly right-wing, which doesn't exclude that he also resorts to left-wing features in different areas, as Trump does when he promises to protect some kinds of industry, or even in the same field. It's not necessarily consistent.
Yeah, but you also say that populism threatens liberal democracy. But really, if you just look at Trump in the last year, despite all the fear-mongering that Trump would somehow be a fascist, he's really been kept in check by the checks and balances of the US government system, hasn't he?
That's true. So far, I'm very happy to see that these checks and balances have been working relatively fine. It doesn't mean that he himself isn't a dangerous populist. It just tells us that institutions matter and that these institutions in the U.S. are pretty well designed.
Yes. And then the France, of course, is a very interesting case study because you have Emmanuel Macron. He represented a backlash against the political establishment, both socialist and conservative in France. Yet he's no extremist, is he? I mean, if anything, he pretty much wants to implement more market-oriented policies to reform the French economy. So would you accept that Macron and his En Marche is a special case?
I think they are indeed a very interesting and special case. France is a country where political polarization of the kind I just had described had also taken place, and it was fostered, first of all, by the dramatically unpopular presidency of François Hollande, who was a socialist, and a very divided conservative groups of parties on the other side. And so something new had to come up, and it did come up. You have extreme right-wing and extreme left-wing parties that now exist. But what Macron managed to do is to create a popular movement which is very inclusive. It is not exclusive, as populists usually work. And he has managed to reconstitute a center, a broad center. We don't know yet whether it will survive and prevail, but so far it has worked well, and I think that's the way to go.
Karen, let's get your reaction to something that Georges Schifflin, he's a Hungarian populist and a politician, he's also a member of the European Parliament. This is what he told me recently.
Something like 30%, 40%, depending on the country you're in, of the population is estranged from the hegemonic liberal elite. It's not the kind of liberalism they want. In street language, they're being dissed. The net result of which is that they listen to political groups which say, look, we will look after your interests. This is what Marine Le Pen has done in France. Look at the figures for the alternative in Germany, Alternative für Deutschland. They do very well in the former GDR. The former GDR was treated by West Germany as, I'm going to exaggerate a bit, as a semi-colony. Their own voice was not heard very large. It's the losers of globalization who are being excluded from the political system by the winners. So don't be surprised that there is what you would call a backlash.
That was Georges Schifflin. He's a Hungarian politician and member of the European Parliament on Between the Lines a few weeks ago. Karen.
Yeah, well, that was a typical populist statement indeed, the purpose of which is to create a new mental frame. I think it's important to understand that populism cannot only be described or explained in a demand-side approach where you ask why people find it attractive, but also by looking at the techniques that people on the supply side use. And Schifflin is one of them. And he's a member of Fidesz, Viktor Orban's right-wing populist party that is taking liberal democracy down in Hungary. And if you pay attention to the language he's just been using, you'll easily recognize what he stands for. He uses terms like estranged from the hegemonic liberal elite. Estranged is a term he can use to affirm who the real people are, and hegemonic, he says, to nail down the idea that the rest is illegitimate. Both are incendiary fictions. The 30-40% that Schifflin refers to are in reality much less, and there is no hegemon in a liberal democratic order.
Yeah, but doesn't he have a point when he argues that these populist characters represent legitimate grievances of the losers of globalization? And by the way, rapid technological change, that's a fair point, isn't it?
Well, of course, they are losers of globalization, of course, and that's why it's easy to say that he has a point, and that's why he says it. But most serious empirical studies show that it's not the economically weak, the losers of globalization, if you will, who are the most vulnerable or the most receptive to populism. It is much more culture that attracts people to populism, and it has to do with modern lifestyles, religions, cultures, internationalism, democratic governance, all these kinds of things that more old-fashioned thinking people don't like. So it's especially the older generation, white men, the less educated, who would adopt populist views. So it's much more that than the economic point of view. This has just not been proven empirically. And given this, Schifflin's statement is particularly beside the point if you look at Hungary. Under socialism, people had something you would want to call artificial job guarantees. They were protected against globalization, yes, but these guarantees weren't worth much. Now they don't have that anymore, but it makes them losers of socialism, late losers of socialism, if you will, but not losers of globalization.
Okay, but now back to your Mont Pelerin Society paper. You've written about, quote, the destructive naivety displayed in the Brexit campaign. Now, we've had many Brexiteers on this program over the last 2 years, Karen. What's so wrong with voters reaffirming their nation's sovereignty?
I have no problem with sovereignty. Nothing is wrong with that. Sovereignty is a high value and it is constitutive of democracy and modern government. That's not the problem. What I meant when I wrote or said that there was some destructive naivete in place, I meant other things. First, I meant the naivete by which the plebiscite was being used, which is a dangerous device in a country that isn't used to it and doesn't have the necessary institutional safeguards. People have to decide in a binary way. It's yes or no, and it's once and probably for all on an issue that is much more complicated than that. I live in Switzerland right now. The Swiss do this all the time. They are used to it, and their political system is one where people can vote, learn, change their mind, vote again whenever they want. And there's a permanent negotiation going on. That's a very different kind of institutional framework and mindset. Second, what I meant is that nobody seemed to have really developed an idea about how to conceive the future relations with the EU. And then you have guys like Boris Johnson, who still repeats his number of £350 million that Brits could save every week. This is just bogus.
Yeah. How do the critics of populism, and you're in the mainstream in most of these countries, how do you help to counter these populist movements? I mean, what to do and what to avoid?
It's very difficult to counter populism because they immunize the people they are catering to. What helps them is that people remain in this in-group, in their echo chamber, and when outsiders explain that they have been either lied to or that they have been manipulated or whatever, they find it more comforting to cast all that aside. So that makes it very dangerous. But I think what we must do is to come up with numbers, with arguments, with examples. They might not choose to listen or think about it, but that's really the only thing we can do. And we must avoid insulting them and entering into their game. We have to reframe immediately when they use incendiary language. That's something we sometimes fall into the trap of just picking up on their language. For example, when someone like Schöpflin, whom you just quoted, uses terms like losers of globalization, etc., well, just don't just repeat the phrase and say it's not that. I did exactly that. but talk about late losers of socialism, try to reframe so that their notion doesn't stay in the public discourse. So that's a problem that comes up all the time. We just use their terms and notions and transport them, and they get more and more anchored in our minds. We should avoid that.
Karen, lovely to chat again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Karen Horn is a lecturer in the history of economic thought at Humboldt University in Berlin.